This is Max Landers, and you are listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. Welcome to my show. Today's PSA is about radios, 91.5 FM College Radio PSA. 91.5 FM is a college and community radio no matter where you are in eastern Massachusetts. If you're driving northeast from Tufts, check out some underground radio over at WUML in Lowell, broadcasting from UMass Lowell. If you're driving southeast, tune in to hear lots of great programming over at WZLY in Wellesley, broadcasting from Wellesley College. Support community radio by tuning in and engaging with local stations. And remember, if it's 91.5, then it's good college radio. This has been a message in the public interest from WMFO and Tufts Freeform Radio. My guest today is Jacob Fridman. He is a syndicated columnist at the Tufts Daily Newspaper, the founder and president of the Tufts chapter of New Liberals, founder and host of the Gen Zers podcast, and political co-chair of the Tufts Friends of Israel. Outside of campus, he has previously interned at the Massachusetts State Senate and numerous news media organizations, and was founder and manager of People's Big News, a media platform dedicated to nonpartisan American news. Profoundly dedicated to his craft and a truly engaged member of the Tufts community, Jacob, welcome on.
Thank you. Well, happy to be here.
Yeah. So, Jacob, can you tell me a little bit more about your background and when your political commitments really began to take shape?
Thank you. So, I'm from New Massachusetts. I'm 20 minutes outside of Tufts, and I come from a great family. My dad is an immigrant from Mexico, came here in the 80s for school, and my mom is from Providence, Rhode Island, and she's been active in the Democrats all her life, and she got me interested in politics when, during the 2016 election. She was telling me about the Republican primaries, Democratic primaries, and I was in middle school, okay? So this is my first real introduction to any of that. And so I got really interested, and I started looking more into it. And when Trump won, that was a big, wake-up call. What are we doing here? And so I started People's Big News, as you mentioned, as a way to get people involved, and it just continued on throughout middle school, throughout high school, and now at Tufts. And I am just happy to be here talking with you today.
That's super. Thanks for coming on. So what would you say are the experiences and influences in your life that have shaped your political identity, your family, or have there been mentors in the past that have kind of shaped who you are?
So, as I said, my dad's immigration story is big for me. I'm big on immigration. It's a big moving point in my political philosophy. My mom, too. My My grandmother on my mom's side is a school teacher. She retired now. She taught in all sorts of public systems in Providence, Rhode Island for a few decades. And so that shaped a lot of how I feel about unions, the education system. And also say that just doing all these different activities, as you mentioned, really shaped how I feel about the media, our political system, the party systems. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm just glad to be part of a new thing now, Tufts New Liberals, as a way to really expand my craft and expand my viewpoints.
Yeah, that's great. Let's go on to Tufts New Liberals. So could you give the audience a general description of what that is? Because, you know, I think for a lot of people it would be they may be a little confused on what the term New Liberals actually means. Could you explain that?
Okay, so we are a grassroots organization dedicated to social liberal ideas. And the Tufts chapter is about influencing our state and local representatives and educating people on campus about those ideas. So you may think, social liberal, what the heck is that?
Yeah.
Well, we're basically sandwiched between the Bernie-esque progressivism, mm-hmm, and like the Joe Manchin, social conservatism, you know, still like a lot of liberal aspects in terms of free market markets and, you know, Medicaid expansion, for example.
Okay.
So we're about free markets, robust social safety net. So we want to try and marry the two, like Bill Clinton tried to do in the 90s. But we want to expand that. We want to put that into the modern day. So we're a lot about free movement for people, goods, and capital. We're about abundant housing. We're about criminal justice reform, clean energy, and a carbon tax. A lot of these ideas are rather niche. Some of them are very popular. But we have a very big ideology that goes back to the Clinton years. It goes back to this, you know, neoliberalism that has been derided in recent years. We want to reform that. We want to say, okay, we can survive and evolve into the 21st century. And it can exist with the sense of progressivism. We call ourselves, at Tufts, pragmatic progressives for a reason, because we believe in things like trans rights. We believe that things like Ron DeSantis is doing in Florida are just wrong. Mm-hmm. We believe that people should be able to be however they want to be. We believe that people should have the autonomy to do what they want with their bodies. We believe in abortion rights for existence. And, you know, but we do believe that the doomerism and populism of, say, Bernie-esque progressivism of the squad is unfortunately not the right solution for, you know, a very well, you know, economic system.
Yeah.
And so that's why we are big on, say, the EU's Schengen area. We're big on, you know, free movement for people, goods, and capital. Mm-hmm. And also free markets, while also, yes, maintain that robust social safety net that has left millions of Americans behind.
Super interesting. So is it accurate to say that your organization is kind of marrying almost individual like libertarianism and with respect to, like you said, trans rights and individual identity with this kind of progressive attitude of, you know, it's important to have a social safety net. It's important to make sure that our economy is working for everybody, you know, in kind of a way that Bernie would say. Is that an accurate kind of description of who you guys are?
Yeah. So we are backed by the PPI, the Progressive Policy Institute. Mm-hmm. We also have a lot of friends over at Niskanen Center and writers like Matthew Glacius, Noah Smith, Jerusalem Desmas, and Derek Thompson. We have a lot of our circle of people on Twitter and on, you know, all the more institutions, we have this more of libertarian streak. Mm-hmm. Like Jared Polis in Colorado, a lot of very libertarian sounding ideas, a lot about crypto and a lot about, the land value tax and a bit about reforming the tax system there, that, you know, we want people to have the freedom to do what they want. We want people to grow their business, you know, be who they want to be, in their personal lives. We don't want the government getting involved with a lot of that. And that's why stuff like housing, our big thing at Tufts and Liberals, we want to deregulate housing. We want to say developers should be able to build. Because the housing crisis right now in Medford-Somerville, a lot of that is because of these arcane zoning laws.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That are blocking developers from actually building. We want multifamily homes. We want people to not have to pay thousands and thousands of dollars for rent. That's ridiculous. We want people to have the freedom to choose where they want to live. And that means letting developers, letting businesses, you know, increase the housing supply.
Sure. Absolutely. And could you elaborate a little bit more on those zoning laws and how it impacts the Medford-Somerville community?
So, you know, a lot of it is about multifamily homes. A lot of it is about exclusionary single-family zoning.
Okay.
So you can only build single-family homes in this area. You can't build multifamily homes in a lot of areas. You know, this is not only in Medford-Somerville. This is in a lot of cities across the United States. And we just think it's wrong. We think that people should be able to build, people should be able to live however they want to live in, you know, and developers should be able to build whatever they want to build.
Mm-hmm. And how would you say this impacts the people at the Tufts community? Would you say the working population in the Medford-Somerville area? Do you think it's very detrimental to them at large?
Of course. Rents are going up. That's been a big thing in Somerville, especially. And, you know, students looking for off-campus housing, the prices are going up. And a lot of students, you know, a lot of middle-income students are feeling the hurt right now because they don't have a lot of the support that lower-income mm-hmm. students do. And a lot of the wealthier students, they are able to buy, you know, have that, you know, sure. afford that rent increase. And, you know, Tufts had a great working group a few years ago that said the exact thing where, you know, a lot of these students have become commuter students because they can't afford to live either, you know, be on campus or live off campus in their, you know, junior and senior years.
Super interesting. Would you say Tufts has done anything outside of your organization to kind of amend this problem, or has it been kind of unignored?
So they Tufts is building that, it's going to try to build that new student dorm mm-hmm. to alleviate some of their, you know, on-campus housing concerns. And there's also been, outreach efforts by some Tufts students and by the administration does want to help, you know, the sense of community. But we believe that, frankly, the city could do a lot more, that mm-hmm. the state, honestly, could do a lot more. And part of that is reforming the zoning laws, reforming a lot of these also environmental review laws okay. that kneecap a lot of the development in the state, in
okay.
the city.
So would you say that the main two ways that, I guess the immediate steps that our representatives can take is to reform the zoning laws and mm-hmm. also the environmental regulations that are kind of hampering the construction in the area and our ability to develop, to keep up with the demand in the area?
Absolutely. Stuff like MEPA, the Massachusetts Environmental Policy, that the state level version of NEPA, extremely dangerous, extremely limiting in what can be built. Mm-hmm. And that's not just about housing, it's about transportation, it is about climate. A lot of these things that liberals care about, progressives care about, even conservatives who want, you know, a functioning state really care about. It's being kneecapped on all fronts by MEPA and these zoning regulations. And at Tufts and Liberals, we believe that these regulations must be either abolished or reformed.
Interesting. Okay. And what other issues is your organization tackling along with housing?
Climate. We're big on, you know, clean energy and, you know, MEPA, what mm-hmm. I've just discussed. And also the social safety net. We're also big on, you know, cash payments. The expanded child tax credit is a big part of my personal political philosophy, how we should be, our safety net should be more about giving people the room to grow instead of mandating all these, you know, arcane, restrictions on money like TANF is really doing. And we're also big on, you know, social issues. We're big about protecting abortion rights. We're big on the LGBTQ+ community. Mm-hmm. And we want people to have the freedom to be who they want to be. You know, we should not be instituting, you know, Ron DeSantis type laws, you know, in Massachusetts. Sure. And, you know, that's unlikely, but we still have elements of that, you know, in the state, and that should be fought against wherever possible.
Got it. And when was your first, I'm just super curious, when was your first exposure to new liberal ideas, or I guess the PPI and your work today?
So part of that was on Twitter. I'm active on Twitter. I do mostly a lot of retweeting. Mm-hmm. And I saw a lot of the, you know, new liberal posts. So they're, you know, started as a Twitter account, really. And I also got involved with a few other active chapter leads across the country. Shout out to Micah Irfan of the Houston New Liberals. He was a big part of how I got into it. I had him on my show, actually, my Gen Z Talk Politics, last year. And he introduced me to how this organization really ran and how, you know, all these issues are really connected and how, you know, New Liberals is about solving these issues in ways that a lot of progressives aren't really talking about, a lot of mainstream conservatives aren't really talking about anymore.
Got it. And with respect to Tufts and, like, specifically, what is one thing that students should know about your organization that is just, you know, the key, most important thing?
You know, we have great political organizations on this campus. You sure. know, I'm not about to knock Tufts Dems or Tufts GOP. You guys are great. We love what you're doing. and we want to get involved with you. We are not saying, you know, we're going to endorse these candidates, we're going to primary anyone. You know, we are not about endorsing candidates. We're about issues, okay? Mm-hmm. We want the issues we care about to grow, and we don't care how that's going to happen. We're about advocacy, we're about influencing representatives. We're not going to start competing with anyone. You know, at the end of the day, we're just about a better world. And that means that we want to collaborate with you. We want to collaborate with anyone on campus who wants to get involved with these issues. And if you don't feel like social liberal or new liberal is the exact type of term that you would describe yourself as, you know, you don't really have to be a member. You can still come to our events. You can still, get involved with, going to city council meetings and whatever. But, you know, We want all the support we can get. You know, if you want to join us, great. You know, there's a whole process, and you can join us. Or if not, you know, come to our events. You know, just, you know, we want to educate. We want to get people to understand. You know, all these issues are about, you know, all these issues that not a lot of people really talk about, and we want to help people, you know, just see a better future.
I see. Okay, sounds like you guys need a seat at the debate table. You know, every year. Or I guess every semester, Tufts has that, you know, Democrats, Republicans, Democratic Socialist debate. I think you guys deserve a seat at the table as well.
Thank you. You know, we're on the path to a recognition. We are TCUJ pending recognition, okay. And hopefully, you know, we'll be able to get on the next debate stage.
Perfect. All right. And will you have a table this coming semester? So this next fall at the club fair. Just advertising that. Should Tufts students be aware of that?
Hopefully we will. Again, we are pending, so, you know, it's so some limitations of what we can do. But, if you listening are interested in what we're doing, you know, follow us on social media, go to the website, and, we want to hear from you. You'll reach out to us. We want to engage with you.
Awesome. All right. Well, let's move on to our next topic, which I personally don't have too many notes about. And Jacob, this conversation, you know, will be led by you, and that is national politics and political issues on the national scale that you are passionate about. So what are some issues that you are galvanized by, and what has been your engagement with those topics?
Mm-hmm. So number one, liberal democracy. We see at home with the January 6th, 2 years ago, it's still a major issue. Mm-hmm. Democracy deniers, election deniers. They lost in a lot of battleground states, but the threat is still out there, folks. You know, even though, you know, in Congress right now, we still have a lot of people who denied the election, who denied the results of the election, who still voted to overturn the results. And that's just dangerous democracy. And abroad, Ukraine, you know, new liberals, you know, we are big on international institutions. We're big on NATO and European Union and WTO. And as much as we can say, oh, these organizations, you know, they have a lot of mistakes, there's a lot of missteps, the organization's not always the best, but they get a lot of stuff done. You know, President Biden, I commend him for getting the world to support Ukraine. That would not have been possible under Trump, under Obama, even under Bush, or even under Clinton. So the work that has been done through international institutions, through the liberal world order, has been amazing, but the fight is not over. China is now supporting Russia directly in this war with lethal weapons and whatnot, I believe. And we cannot let up. We cannot let up. Europe got off really easy with a warmer winter helped with the energy shortages. But we need to keep supporting them. We cannot let up, and we cannot let any forces here at home, whether on the extreme left or the extreme right, undercut aid to Ukraine.
All right. Are there some new steps that you think Biden should take in order to, you know, we're at basically the 1 year anniversary of the beginning of the Ukraine conflict. Are there next steps that Biden should take in order to, further our hand in this conflict?
You know, I don't know if there's much else you can do besides actively get involved, which, you know, that's the one line we really can't do. We can't, you know, there was a whole thing about closing the skies and doing a no-fly zone. Unfortunately, that just was not possible. But, you know, supporting Ukraine through all the aid we can give them, all the military equipment we can give them, Europe, all the new energy sources we can give them, a lot of the climate investments are tied to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. You know, we cannot be just relying on coal and natural gas anymore. We need to start, you know, getting a lot of these greener energy sources like nuclear online, even though, you know, yes, nuclear is non-renewable and there is a danger there, it is still a very efficient energy source. And we should be, you know, getting Germany to turn their nuclear plants back online to supply them with energy to, you know, get through the next winter.
Great. And can you remind the audience why Germany shut those nuclear reactors down in the first place? Was it just kind of public sentiment of this is it dangerous, even though it really isn't? Or is it just it's non-renewable, we should be investing in, you know, wind, solar, or other energy sources? What was the rationale behind that?
Yeah, so after, I believe, Fukushima in 2011, you know, a lot of the nuclear plants were taken down by a tsunami, mm-hmm. and a lot of horrible radiation, which is a horrible tragedy. And in Germany, a lot of their energy came from nuclear. And Chancellor Angela Merkel at the time said, you know, this is too dangerous, and we just shut them off. And a lot of the public agreed with her. And look, I agree, nuclear can be very dangerous. There is a real danger in the old school nuclear, you know, plants, sure. that have been built decades ago. You know, Chernobyl still is in the minds of many Americans. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, the great miniseries on HBO, I thought was really good, that showed the dangers of nuclear meltdown. But times are changing, honestly. There has been a lot of innovation on the nuclear front. Well, yes, it is still very costly, and costs are not going down. A lot of that is because we are shutting down nuclear plants, not only in Germany, but in the United States. A few states have been shutting down nuclear plants, have been shutting down a lot of these, you know, longstanding forms of reliable energy. Mm-hmm. And frankly, we should not be doing that. And I'm proud that, very happy that the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, has been moving forward on some of these issues of cleaner energy. And hopefully, a lot of that will expand to nuclear.
Got it. Very cool. And I guess, can you remind me what your first political issue, your most important political issue was?
Liberal democracy.
Liberal democracy.
Both at home and abroad.
January 6th. That's what I was going to mention. Okay. Mm-hmm. So since January 6th, I guess, what has been the longstanding legacy of that day for Americans and, you know, for the idea of democracy at large?
Well, I think there's a couple. Mm-hmm. One is that both sides of them, that some of the media play, especially on Fox News, where it's just asking questions, just false. It's mm-hmm. just false. You know, when you have independents like Tulsi Gabbard, Kyrsten Sinema saying both sides have really a problem, it's just not true. Look, Antifa is a problem. What happened in Atlanta, Georgia recently, that's a problem. We cannot have people going around with anarchy. We cannot have that. But it's nowhere near as big of a problem to the foundations of the liberal order that our country rests on than January 6th, and the people running in the midterms saying mail-in ballots are a fraud and mm-hmm. Joe Biden is an illegitimate president. That is just not, that's just not true. And a lot of these, you know, appeals to, you know, nonpartisanship and centrism, this, you know, anti-political party approach, it flies in the face of what democracy really is. We're not Athens. We are not going to have, you know, direct democracy mm-hmm. with millions and millions of people voting on every single issue. That's just not possible. We need political parties strong political parties, really, to really guide voters, to really give them options, in a sense, to really show that, okay, there are a lot of policies that voters should be educated about, that they should be able to vote on through, you know, elections and whatnot. But parties really need to step up their game here. Post-1968, the primary system where voters have direct elections of the candidates, it's been a disaster. Donald Trump would have never won the 2016 nomination if the party leaders got to pick. And I'm not saying party leaders are perfect. I've certainly been upset at party leaders a couple of times myself. But we can't have voters in congressional districts, for instance, picking Marjorie Taylor Greene again.
Sure.
You know, we can't have that.
Got it. That's an interesting, actually, comment. I've never thought about that with respect to parties, because, you know, I remember being in AP US history class and hearing George Washington famously being against political parties and the emergence of political parties.
Right.
But like you just said, they do serve, even though with their many faults, they do serve a very important purpose, which is to guide the voters and to direct the voters, I guess, with respect to policy and issues, but also to candidates, as you just mentioned.
Right. And, you know, of course, we want people to be independent. We want people to make rational choices.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, And look, right, parties are not always the right solution, and I agree the two-party system is woefully inadequate to our current day and age. You know, I'm a big advocate of proportional representation of STV, single transferable vote, for the House, and some type of approval or ranked choice voting for the Senate, and, you know, abolishing the Electoral College for the presidency, because I do believe that we need to have more, you know, proportional, more more results that accurately reflect what the citizens want. But we do, again, yeah, right, we do need parties. We do need forces in our lives that say, okay, here's a list of candidates, here's people who support these types of issues. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people do fall under, you know, different types of, you know, median sort of voter of issues. And should we have more parties to reflect that? Absolutely. But should we get rid of parties to allow those voters to do whatever they want? No.
No.
We should not.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And I guess back to the idea of the erosion of democracy, what do you think today is the greatest threat to democracy? Because, you know, Joe Biden, a lot of what Joe Biden stands for is being the bulwark, or at least he wants to be the bulwark against this idea of the threat to the soul of the nation, to democracy itself. What do you think is that threat?
Well, you know, President Biden, he's done a very good job at showing that democracy can work, that 2022 was a great year, actually. You know, Ukraine, the IRA, the bipartisan gun bill. And we could debate the merits of some of these policies, whether they went far enough, whether the right solutions at all. But in a gridlock of the Trump years and also the Obama years, where not a lot got done from 2010 to 2017, then, you know, after 2019, when Democrats took the House again, it seemed like that the system we have now just won't ever produce real legislation again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I know I just talked about how, you know, nonpartisanship and centrism as a whole, you know, red herring here, but sure. Also bipartisanship, the appeal to bipartisanship in of itself is also can be a little, you know, oh, nothing's really ever going to change. And, you know, I agree with that sentiment where, you know, two parties don't represent everyone, that, you know, again, we do need proportional representation. But but President Biden, yes, he's had that middle ground where we can have, you know, parties, and we can have bipartisanship, and we can have the sense of, okay, America can actually work. The system we have can produce results that do affect a lot of people in a very positive way that does increase life expectancy, GDP, and all the things we do care about as a country. And honestly, part of the reason why I helped found the Tufts chapter of New Liberals is because a lot of the, you know, doomer idea that the system is broken, nothing's ever going to change, that things should go back to the 1950s.
Yeah.
It's just corrosive to the idea that politics is something that could be used for, you know, lift all boats.
Mm-hmm.
And that applies to both the people on January 6th who want to throw out votes of people in swing states,
mm-hmm.
particularly racial minorities, people of color, and, you know, who say that we should go back to, you know, protectionism and free and, you know, yeah. a 1950s style policy, and people on, you know, progressives who say that the world is going to end in 12 years due to climate change.
Yeah.
And look, I am all for combating climate change. I'm a big fan of the IRA, of what that's done for climate. And I agree that climate change is a big problem that not a lot of people really care about.
Sure.
But the idea that it's somewhat useless to, you know, function society to really have a political, you know, argument over the best types of solutions to climate change, because everything's going to die in 12 years, I just don't think that's productive. And so, you know, New Liberals, we're hoping to have that sense of, okay, we can have a functioning liberal democracy. We can have people who feel all represented in all, you know, walks of life. And we can have policies that not only can incorporate a lot of what people are feeling right now, mm-hmm. with inflation, with climate change, with the economic state of the country, and we can move forward. We can move forward into the 2020s now, with a sense of, you know, American renewal.
Got it. Okay. And what do you think are, like? Oh, Spencer Walsh is calling in. Shall we answer?
Sure.
All right. I'm gonna put Spencer on. Let's see if I remember to do this. Spencer, you're on the air. Hello? Spencer, can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right. Hey, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
Good. We have Jacob on the air right now, and do you have any questions for him, I guess is the question.
Yeah, I just had one big question. You just talked about, I was very interested to hear about how your biggest concern is for, like, liberal democracy and making sure that the U.S. Supports liberal democracy all throughout the world and also at home. And you mentioned the issue of Ukraine, which I think is, I agree with you, I think is very important. I was wondering, like, what should the United States do to ensure that countries that we give a lot of aid and military support to, like Saudi Arabia and Israel, what do we do to make sure that they also uphold the principles of liberal democracy? Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Spencer. Look, I'm going to speak for myself here. I think the role of the United States as a sort of global policeman, unfortunately, has taken a beating in the past 20 years. You know, Iraq and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the fall of Afghanistan withdrawal. And obviously, yes, we should absolutely take a human rights approach, what President Biden has tried to do in some countries around the world, like Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Just recently, Vice President Harris calling out Russia for war crimes. I think having a one-size-fits-all approach to aid to Saudi Arabia, to Israel, to a lot of countries right now is unfortunately a fool's errand. I think that we need to look at the situation as it is. And look, Israel and Saudi Arabia are very different countries, the ones you mentioned. And, the situations there are different. And the aid we give them is also different, how much we give them, how much support they do need. And a lot of this does depend on how international institutions, the role we play in them, say the UN Security Council, those systems that, like I said before, are very flawed. I have my own gripes with how they've dealt with situations, that we need to really focus on reforming how other countries also play a role, because this is not an area where we can say, look, the United States can go it alone and be, you know, the big superpower of the world. We do need other countries to really, you know, rope countries in with free trade agreements and all sorts of military agreements. And that does require international institutions. That does require, against China, against Russia, against in Ukraine, the war there. And, you know, a part of aid, you know, look, given what's happening in Israel right now, so that was one of the examples, with the judicial reform, mm-hmm, of Prime Minister Netanyahu. I'm personally against it. I am not a fan of Bibi at all. I think it's very corrosive to the nature of Israeli democracy, and I would like to see a ton of other ideas for reform rather than the ones that he proposed. And, you know, and look, that is a whole can of worms that involves domestic influences in the United States, involves anti-Semitism, because that is a big issue of when you start talking about this. And I am, I'm someone that has been burnt out, honestly, by the fact that everyone starts yelling and we cannot, and it gets so caught up in semantics, and we should be having a real conversation about what should be done and how to really do that without resorting to anti-Semitic tropes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and unfortunately, I don't want to get into that without having the whole, you know, 9-paragraph discussion.
Sure.
But, you know, I will just say, to sum it up, it really depends on case-by-case basis, but we should be, first and foremost, making sure the international institutions that are designed to really facilitate a lot of the contact we have between the United States and a lot of these countries and rest of the world, because, again, we're not in a world where America is really isolated anymore. We do need those institutions to start working. And so what President Biden should really be doing is going to the UN and going to EU and NATO, especially NATO, and say, okay, what works, what doesn't, you know, what should we be doing to reform these institutions organizationally and bureaucratically?
Got it. Awesome. Before we move on to our last section, are there any other issues that you want to talk about or discuss?
I want to hear the last question. I want to hear what topics you have.
Awesome. So the last section is coming back to Tufts locally,
mm-hmm,
and thinking about what the political environment is like at Tufts University and your thoughts on, I guess, how we can improve if there are deficiencies with respect to the, you know, Tufts's political environment, mm-hmm. and what it's like to be a civically engaged student on this campus, if that makes sense. I guess my first question is, Tufts, as a place, I would say, is a pretty tolerant, you know, institution at the end of the day,
right.
in a lot of different ways. But perhaps, and I actually talk with, I don't know if you know him, Dr. Proctor, you know,
yes.
Mr. Dr. Proctor. And one thing that he mentioned when I interviewed him was he was not very, when I asked him, so do you believe Tufts is a tolerant environment? He did say yes, but he did say that it was not as tolerant with the free, like with the freedom of, I guess the free dissemination of ideas from mm-hmm. all sides. And the idea of having, you know, academically based, reasonable political debate on campus. Would you say that you would agree that it's hard to have those kinds of tough political conversations on campus? And what has your experience been?
I would say that I do agree with them in some respect. I would say that anti-Semitism in particular has been a major, major problem for this campus, particularly in the past decade.
Mm-hmm.
And the recent protest disrupting the event with the FOI and J Street about Roots, this activist peace organization getting together Palestinians and Israelis in the West Bank. And again, I know I just said I'm not going to try to go into all this backstory, but
sure.
this is an important moment for Tufts that, you know, this, I haven't been a part of FOI. As someone who's on our board last spring 2022, and as someone who wrote the response to the SJP's boycott of some goods sold in Tufts campus that was also last year, I would say that event really shook me.
Yeah.
That look, this is, of course, as I said before, this is a major issue, that this is not something that should be taken with, you know, 10 minutes on a radio show. It should not be, you know, disseminated until, what should we do with the conflict? How should this resolve?
Yeah.
But, well, we do need to have these conversations, and we do need to really think about what we talk about, how we bring it up, how we talk about this conflict really affects the people on the ground, how it affects people in the diaspora for both Israelis, Jews, and Palestinians,
mm-hmm.
and what happened at the event on campus this past week, it's just another sign that part of the campus culture, talking about conflict, is just broken. And I'm a part of the I'm taking the experimental college class on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and that is a great course that should be that I think a lot of people should take if they are interested in the conflict at all. They're interested in hearing about the history and how other people view the conflict, because it's eye-opening for me, honestly, as someone even I've gone to Israel a couple times, who has tried to see all sides of conflict. It's been eye-opening for me in that class,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I just wish that we have more things like that on campus, and
yeah.
more events like the one that was disrupted, because there are good people on this campus have multiple different opinions on this issue that should be talking about the effects of the conflict, the effects of independent Israeli state and the Palestinian state, future Palestinian state, on the people on the ground and in the diaspora. And I just say that I just hope that whatever happens in the next 2 years I'm on campus, that things get better. And I do hope that the campus climate does improve, that we are getting out of the 2010s period of division, period of massive social upheaval, that we're starting to really come towards a, you know, let's come to the table. Let's actually talk about the issues. Let's talk about, you know, issue X, issue Y, how these people are affected, not just say that, you know, I saw this in social media, then therefore these entire people are not, you know, worthy of my time.
Got it. And I have two follow-up questions, so we'll answer them one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
The first question is, from my understanding with discussions with other people in your group specifically, it seems like the opposing student, or I guess not really the opposing, but the Palestinian student group on campus has been relatively, I guess hasn't, you've called to like have these kinds of discussions before in the past, and I've really tried to bridge that gap. But those efforts have been unsuccessful, and they've kind of blocked you. What are your wishes going forward for the next, like you said, 2 years? And what would you want that? What would you want to say to them to kind of begin that process of healing and rebuilding that bridge? I guess, as I said.
First, I would just say that you can't force people to the table. Mm-hmm. You can't say, okay, sit down, we're going to talk about this. That's just not how we do things in America. That's not how we should be doing things on a college campus. I think what needs to be said is that people who are angriest about what's happening on the ground in the West Bank and in Gaza and in the Green Line within the original 1967 borders in what the international community calls Israel. The people who are angriest about that, a lot of times they have a lot of legitimate grievances and legitimate reasons to be angry. And that includes the people who are disrupting the event. That includes a lot of those people in SJP who are good people. I just have disagreements with them on this issue, how they present it.
Yep.
And I would just say that, you know, we're probably not gonna agree on what the best solution is. And, you know, just because that we do not agree on a base level of what the solution should be does not mean that we should not be talking at all. That doesn't mean we should have, we should not be talking at all. That we should not have a calmer climate. And that does not just go for people on that side of the spectrum. It goes for the people on the other side, FOI, you know. And I haven't heard anything about FOI. I'm not part of FOI anymore, but on their board. But, you know, if anything like that, anything in reverse happens with FOI, disrupting any events or inflammatory language, that also should be absolutely unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And again, whoever wants to be on the table, whoever wants to say, okay, we need to put aside what we have and just talk, to come together and really engage with speakers, engage with action programs from clubs, anyone who wants to come to this table should be welcomed to the table, and we shouldn't be judging the people of SJP, of FOI, of J Street based on the clubs they're in. We should judge them based on how they present themselves and how their own issues and how opinions and how they choose to talk about the conflict in general.
Okay, totally agree with you on all those points. And has the administration really helped you at all with diffusing conflict between these two groups, or have they stepped in at any point to kind of mediate the tensions between these two groups on campus, or have they just kind of, has it been really a student-led, student-driven, interaction?
When I was on the FOI board, I remember that we did try to reach out to SJP and J Street a few times. And J Street, we've had that, you know, the event mm-hmm. that got disrupted. We talk with them. SJP has not talked with us. At least at that time. I don't want to speak for any developments in the past few days, since I'm not a part of the FOI board anymore. But I really do think this is going to have to be student-led. The administration, on some level, there's only so much they can do.
Yeah.
Since they are more higher up, they can't police all the stuff on campus. It's for a number of reasons. But I don't think that much of what they've said in the statements, President Monaco's statements and whatnot, has been the most unifying in a sense of what, you know, let's actually to talk about it rather than just we condemn antisemitism, we condemn Islamophobia, we condemn all these things. On one hand, there's only so much they can do. On the other hand, I wish the tone was a little more, let's
come together.
Or at least, you know, let's not start yelling down each other's points.
Sure.
But I just hope things have to change, honestly.
Got it. Okay. And let's move to more general political atmosphere at Tufts.
Mm-hmm.
What has your perception been, with the student body, You know, a lot of people say, and college campuses in general, I would say the vast majority of people are, you know, left leaning. What is the political dynamic like at Tufts? How would you describe it, and how would you characterize the interaction between, you know, the overwhelmingly large left leaning student body, and I guess the very few right leaning individuals who, you know, Tufts GOP is a good example, but yeah, that are on campus.
I don't know how much I can really speak to that since I'm not a part of Tufts Republicans. I don't have a lot of, I just don't have a lot of experience mm-hmm. with that sort of, you know, scenario.
Sure.
But I will say that a lot of classes, a lot of things on campus, they do, again, they have that liberal bent mm-hmm. and, you know, that teachers should have every right to have their lesson plan. They should go through, you know, review. And of course, all these issues that are being brought up in states right now, you know, Ron DeSantis in Florida with the taking over the new college, that, of course, is abhorrent. It should not be mm-hmm. done, but there should be, there should be more awareness that there are all sorts of students, all walks of life, that come to Tufts and to college campuses in general. And, you know, I think what needs to be said is that we do need to come together. We do need to say, look, there's a sizable minority of people on this campus who are more to the right, mm-hmm. who are more not necessarily Trumpists or anything, but, you know, actually, you know, conservatives, like Mitt Romney conservatives back in 2012. And people on the campus, you know, there should be, from my experience, just my experience, should be more effort to, you know, welcome them into the conversation in classrooms and on campus events, and like the civic debate. That's a great, great way to get all these people together on campus. And, you know, stuff like that should be practiced more. I would say that they should do that more than just once a year. That should be a regular thing. You know, if there's a big thing in the news, like the invasion of Ukraine happened, you know, February 2022, maybe Civic or some other organization should try to similar types of big, debates where these clubs can really talk with different issues, different opinions, talk it out.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that Civic should, I was part of Civic for a time, but I think Civic should really expand their, their campus-wide debate kind of platform, because I thought that was like the most interesting, I guess, and there were a lot of people there too who are like most interesting event that they had, and also there were a lot of people I thought that probably agreed. I believe they touched on healthcare last time and some other topics, but it was super interesting. I think that, like you said, there's a huge tableau of policy issues that we should be talking about on campus, and it's really hard to kind of distill all of those ideas into a 45-minute debate and just have it once a semester, right? So totally agree. All right, well, let's pivot one last time back to you and your aspirations for the future and what you're looking forward to doing here in the last 2 years. Are there any, I guess, short or long-term plans that you have for your organization on campus, or new issues that you want to tackle, and like coming like after graduation, like what do you want to be doing? What's the dream?
I'd say just for Tufts New Liberals, we're hoping to really step up with events. We've had a lot of watch parties. We've had a few meetups, but we want to expand, and we're looking forward to what the rest of the semester holds. And next year, we're going to have some things planned. And, you know, if you're listening, you're interested in anything I've said today about Tufts New Liberals, as I said, go to our social media, go sign up on our email list, and see what we're about. And for me personally, after graduation, I don't know. I mean, you know, as long as I take good classes, get good grades, meet good people, I think I'm fine. And, you know, if I end up in Boston or D.C., as I want to be, you know, I'll be happy.
Perfect. All right. Well, Jacob Friedman, thanks for coming on the show. Really a great conversation. Really appreciate your time today. And thank you for all your insights into, you know, what you do and the state of politics, local and national and international. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Have a good one. Mm-hmm. This is Max Landers, and you are listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. Have a good day. Bye.
Grudges, hoping for your turn.